Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're going to explore the lives of nomadic Kurdish communities before the 20th century. We're drawing on quite a bit of research to try and paint a picture of their way of life.
And it's interesting right from the start, isn't it, how the term Kurd itself seems to have been, well, somewhat fluid back then.
Fluid? How so?
Well, our sources suggest it wasn't always the kind of fixed ethnic label we think of now. Often, it seems, it described a socioeconomic group. People who were nomadic, lived in tents, mainly shepherds.
Ah, okay. So being nomadic was almost part of the definition in a way.
Exactly. It shows just how central that mobile existence was to how they were perceived and maybe how they saw themselves in those earlier times.
And the actual land, Kurdistan, with the mountains and the seasonal pastures, that wasn't just a backdrop, was it?
No, not at all. It actively shaped their traditions, their economy, and importantly, their ability to maintain a degree of autonomy from the big empires around them.
How did the terrain help with autonomy?
Well, the mountains provided natural defenses, you know. And the need for seasonal grazing often put them on the edges of imperial control. This geography meant less direct administration, allowing tribal ways to persist.
Got it. So today we want to look at the key parts of this nomadic society. We'll touch on their social structures, how they dealt with empires, their economic life, their material culture, the things they made and used, and their oral traditions.
Right. And it's crucial to understand that nomadism wasn't just their job, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
It was deeply woven into their social fabric. It was a source of military power and is fundamental to their culture for a very long time.
How did that constant movement shape their sense of community? That's something to keep in mind as we go.
Okay, let's start with how they organized themselves. The research really points to tribal structures and kinship tracing ancestry through the male line as being fundamental.
That's the core, yes.
Yeah.
And it was hierarchical. Think of it like nested layers. You start with the household, the basic family unit.
Then several related households form a lineage, people who share a fairly recent common male ancestor.
Makes sense.
Multiple lineages who believe they descend from an even more distant ancestor make up a clan. And then various clans would form a tribe. Sometimes these tribes even joined together into bigger confederations.
So blood ties were key, but it wasn't only about blood relations holding them together. Loyalty to strong leaders seems important too, and it sounds like outsiders could sometimes become part of the group.
Precisely. Kinship was the bedrock, but leadership, charisma, and political necessity play huge roles. And yes, integration of outsiders or client groups definitely happened.
And they had specific words for these different levels.
Yes. The sources mention terms like Ahirit, Tira, Haz, Il, Kel, Taifa, Zuma, and Rama. The exact meaning might vary a bit regionally or over time, but they all point to these different layers of social belonging.
Now, this is where that's really interesting for me. It seems the bigger tribes weren't just, you know, one big group. There was internal hierarchy, social layers.
Yes, definitely. Within many larger tribes, you'd often find what you could call noble lineages, families who traditionally provided the chieftains.
Okay, the leaders.
Below them were the commoner clans, the main body of the tribe. And then you often had client lineages, maybe groups from different origins, who'd attach themselves to the tribe for protection or opportunity, owing loyalty.
And sometimes these elites controlled more than just herds.
In some cases, yes. They might control agricultural land worked by settled peasants, or even the labor of those peasants. It hints at a kind of, well, some scholars call it tribal feudalism, where nomadic power extended beyond just the pastoral sphere.
The Mili tribe in the 19th century sounds like a great example of this diversity.
It really is. You had Arab and Kurdish groups,
yeah.
Yazidis and Sunni Muslims, all under the Mili umbrella. It shows tribal identity could be quite complex, not just about shared ancestry or religion.
So let's talk leadership. We see terms like aga and beg. What's the difference?
Generally speaking, an aga was more likely the head of a smaller unit, a clan, maybe a major lineage within a tribe. The beg was often a higher-ranking chief, sometimes hereditary, especially in the larger Kurdish principalities we'll talk about. Think bigger territory, maybe overseeing several agas.
And becoming a chief wasn't just about being born into the right family.
No, it was more complex. Lineage gave you a head start, for sure. The prestige mattered. But personal qualities were huge: bravery, generosity, wisdom. You also needed to build consensus within the tribe, have political skill, and crucially get support from allies, maybe even the empires.
And the aga's guest house, the Memminkane. That sounds important socially.
Oh, incredibly important. It wasn't just for hosting guests. It was the main public space, the place where men gathered, discussed issues, settled disputes, made collective decisions. It was the heart of the community's political and social life.
And getting recognition from, say, the Ottomans or Persians that could boost a chief's power.
Absolutely. External recognition added legitimacy and resources. Chieftains often had to be skilled diplomats, balancing the needs of their tribe with the demands of the empires they bordered. They were intermediaries.
You mentioned a segmentary lineage system. How did that work in practice?
It's a way anthropologists describe how societies based on kinship mobilize. Basically, the closer the kinship tie, the stronger the obligation to support each other. In a small dispute, maybe just close cousins get involved. In a bigger conflict, whole lineages or clans might unite against another group. Me against my brother, me and my brother against my cousin, me and my brother and my cousin against the world kind of idea.
But powerful leaders could attract followers beyond just their relatives.
Yes, definitely. Strong, successful chiefs could draw support from various groups, not strictly based on lineage. The Mili Confederation is a case in point. Again, political allegiance could override strict kinship. It gave them flexibility.
And relations between tribes. Sounds like a mix of alliances, rivalries, maybe feuds.
All of the above. Blood feuds were certainly a reality, often between closely related groups competing over resources. In larger conflicts, chieftains were always looking for allies, other tribes, or even support from the empires.
And how were things like pasture rights decided? Was it just whoever was strongest?
It was likely governed by unwritten customary laws, traditions about who could use which pastures and water sources when. Our sources don't always give details, but complex rules must have existed to avoid constant conflict, though disputes obviously still happened.
And it seems these kin groups, clans, lineages became even more central during times of conflict.
Yes, conflict tended to reinforce those kin-based loyalties. They were the fundamental units for maintaining order and mobilizing defense.
Okay, so we have these internal structures. How did they fit into the bigger picture with the large empires around them? You mentioned Kurdish principalities or emirates.
Right. From the medieval period up until the 19th century, quite a few independent or semi-independent Kurdish emirates existed. Places like Ardalan, Badenham, Baban, Soran, Hakkari, Badlis. These were significant regional powers at times.
And the Sharaftama, that text from 1597, is key to understanding them.
It's a crucial source, yes. Written by Sharaf Khan Bidlisi, himself from an emirate family, it details their histories, rulers, and relationships. And a vital point it highlights is how much these emirates relied on nomadic Kurdish tribes for their military muscle.
The Ardalan dynasty, for instance, held on to power for centuries. That's impressive.
It really is. They navigated complex political landscapes, often acting as vassals to bigger powers like the Turkic federations or Persian empires, right up into the 1860s. Their location was key.
Where were they located mostly?
Strategically, often right on the frontiers between the Ottoman and the Safavid, or later Qajar Persian empires. This buffer zone position was both dangerous and advantageous.
Advantageous how?
It allowed savvy Kurdish leaders to play the empires off against each other, shifting alliances to maintain as much autonomy as possible. It was a constant balancing act, diplomacy, alliances, sometimes conflict.
And the empires, how did they generally deal with these emirates?
Mostly through indirect rule. They'd often grant autonomy, recognize the hereditary rulers, maybe give them privileges like the Yirlik Okaklik system.
What was that?
Essentially, a system granting hereditary rights to rule a territory in exchange for service, like border defense. In return, the empires expected military support, tribute, and keeping the borders secure.
But this autonomy wasn't always stable. There were revolts.
Oh, frequently. Whenever the empires tried to centralize control too much or interfered in succession, you often saw Kurdish resistance. The Jumpulut Revolt, the Raziki Revolt, Sheikh Ubeydullah's uprising in the 19th century. These are famous examples. And the Ottoman Tanzimat reforms aimed at modernization and centralization in the 19th century really put pressure on these emirates.
So these emirates were like mini-states, built on a foundation of tribal confederations.
That's a good way to put it. They weren't just single tribes writ large. They were political structures, often with multiple tribes under a ruling dynasty recognized by an outside empire. They even developed their own administrative systems, sometimes borrowing from the larger empires.
And this reliance on nomadic tribes for soldiers created a kind of mutual need between the emirs and the tribes.
Exactly. The emirs needed the tribes' manpower, their fighting skills. The tribes benefited from the stability, the resources, and maybe the political clout the emirate offered.
That must have made internal politics tricky for the emirs.
Absolutely. They constantly had to manage relationships with powerful tribal chiefs, balancing their own authority against the chief's influence. The health of the pastoral economy was directly tied to the military strength of the emirate.
We have that table summarizing some key principalities. Ardalan's long rule, Maban founding Sulaymaniyah, it really underscores their historical weight.
It does. There were significant players in the region for centuries.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Brosh, Hannah.
Oh, brilliant. Just what we needed. Roj Brosh, Hannah. It smells fantastic today. Is that cardamom I'm getting? Let's give it a try.
Takes a sip. Yes, definitely cardamom. It's got a good strong flavor, but maybe a little on the bitter side today. What do you think?
It takes a sip. You know, I think you might be right. It's robust, definitely. But yeah, a touch bitter. Could use a bit more sugar to balance it out. Still, the warmth is absolutely perfect. Thank you, Hannah. Roj Brosh.
Agreed on the sugar, but lovely and warming nonetheless. Thanks, Hannah. Roj Brosh.
Okay, let's just enjoy this for a moment. Then we can dive back into the rhythms of daily life for these nomadic communities.
That's better. Right, so before modernity really changed things, Kurdish life was overwhelmingly tied to pastoral nomadism, herding sheep and goats mainly.
Which makes total sense given the mountainous landscape, doesn't it? Ideal for grazing.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had cattle, donkeys, mules, horses, all playing their part, whether for milk, meat, transport, or traction.
And the whole economy basically revolved around these animals.
Pretty much. Animal husbandry was the core. Dairy farming was huge. Milk, butter, cheese, processing wool, meat, hides. They also got grain, maybe through trade with settled farmers or sometimes limited cultivation themselves.
And women had a specific role in the dairy side of things.
Yes, a crucial one. Milking the animals and then processing that milk into storable products like cheese and yogurt, that was primarily women's work and vital for the household economy.
In this constant movement, transhumance, it's called. That was the central pattern.
Absolutely. The seasonal migration between summer and winter pastures was the defining rhythm. Up to the high mountain pastures, the Zazan, in summer.
Right.
And down to the lower, warmer plains or valleys, the Garmian or Kreshlak, in winter.
And this wasn't just families wandering off. It was organized.
Highly organized. Usually planned at the tribal or clan level, following established, often ancestral routes. Some groups traveled huge distances.
Like the example of groups wintering near places like Nusaybin and summering way up near Van or Osra.
Exactly. That's a serious trek. This whole Zozan-Garmian system wasn't just about feeding animals. It was a sophisticated adaptation that shaped their culture, their social bonds, their intimate knowledge of the land.
And managing access to pasture and water must have been critical.
Life or death, really. Pasture was often held communally by the tribe or clan. Access rights were probably governed by customary laws passed down orally. We don't have all the details, but rules must have existed.
But competition still led to conflict.
Oh, certainly. Disputes over grazing land or water sources were common, both between different nomadic groups and between nomads and settled villagers.
And later, Ottoman policy started messing with this traditional system.
Yes, the Tanzimat reforms, particularly land registration policies, started to allow powerful individuals, agas often, to claim ownership over lands that might have been used communally before. That caused major shifts.
How did nomads interact with settled farmers generally? Was it always conflict?
No, it was often symbiotic. Nomads needed grain, tools, things they couldn't produce easily. Settled farmers needed wool, dairy products, meat. So there was regular trade.
But friction could occur.
Yes, especially during the winter quartering, the Kreshlak. A large group of nomads and their animals staying near a village for months could strain local resources like firewood and grazing, leading to tensions. State policies favoring settlement later disrupted this balance even more, often disadvantaging the nomads.
And you mentioned women processing dairy. Their work processing other animal products, like wool for weaving, was also significant economically.
Absolutely. Producing textiles like kilims and carpets wasn't just for household use. These were valuable trade goods and important cultural expressions. This economic contribution likely gave women considerable informal influence within the family and community, even within a broadly patriarchal society.
Let's shift to their material world. The things they lived in and used must have reflected this mobile life.
Completely. The iconic dwelling was the black tent, Res Khan, or Shadir, made from woven black goat hair.
Goat hair? Why that?
It's incredibly durable, provides good insulation against both heat and cold, and it smells when wet, making it remarkably water resistant. Perfect for the varied climate.
Clever.
In some areas, like Anatolia, they also used reed screens called sit, around the outside walls for extra protection or to divide space. Anatolian tents often had several main poles supporting the roof.
And they'd have different tents for different purposes.
Sometimes, yes. Lighter, more portable ones for when they were actively migrating, perhaps heavier, more established ones at their main winter sites. Camps themselves could vary a lot in size, from just a few related families to a whole clan camping together. The tent was the absolute center of life, family, socializing, work.
And their clothing, was it fairly uniform or did it vary?
Well, it varied quite a bit by region before Western styles became common. We know from early sources, like the 13th century, they wore cotton and a distinct head covering, the mantle. For men, baggy trousers, shelwar or shirwal, were very common, with shirts, waistcoats, and a wide sash, the pistin, around the waist.
Any regional differences stand out?
Well, in northern areas, Anatolia, men's clothing was sometimes a bit tighter fitting. The central Kurdistan had the well-known shalu shapik style, a fitted jacket, shapik, those distinctive gathered trousers, shawl, a white shirt, the sash. Southern Kurdish men's clothing was similar in ways, maybe less embroidery sometimes. And headwear for men varied hugely by tribe and region, simple skull caps to elaborate turbans.
And women's clothing?
Generally characterized by layers, bright colors, and often quite a bit of embellishment. Baggy trousers were usually worn under long dresses or gowns. Vests, jackets, aprons, coats were common layers. Materials could range from everyday cotton to fancy velvet, brocade, or silk for special occasions.
Head coverings were important for women, too.
Essential. From simple scarves for daily wear to really elaborate headdresses, sometimes decorated with coins or beads, especially for married women or festivals, 19th century European travelers often commented on the colorful layers and ornate headscarves. The clothing really served as a visual marker of identity, region, tribe, status.
And weaving sounds like it was a really central craft.
Hugely important, and primarily women's work. They produced flat weaves, kilims, and knotted carpets. These weren't just floor coverings. They were used as wall hangings, storage bags, haybi, saddle blankets, cradle covers, everything.
What were they made from, mostly?
Wool, overwhelmingly. It's durable, readily available, and takes natural dyes really well.
Ah, the dyes. Kurdish textiles are famous for their colors, aren't they?
They are. Deep reds, vibrant blues, earthy terracottas, oranges, saffron yellows, often made from local plants and minerals. And the designs weren't just decorative. They were full of symbolism.
Like what kind of symbols?
Motifs representing fertility, like the Elibobind hands-on-hips design, or power, like the Kakboinuzu, ram's horn. Symbols for protection against evil. Symbols indicating tribal affiliation, marking life events. The serpent or dragon motif often pops up, symbolizing luck or strength.
So, in a society where many couldn't read, the textiles were like a visual language.
Exactly. A powerful way to communicate history, beliefs, identity, passed down through generations of women weavers. Besides weaving, other crucial crafts included spinning the wool itself, making ropes, maybe some simple pottery for storage. It all points to incredible resourcefulness.
It's amazing how their material culture was so tied to their lifestyle and beliefs. How did this connect with their non-material culture stories, music?
They were deeply intertwined. In a largely non-literate society, oral tradition, spoken word, song, shared practices was how everything got passed down. History, values, cultural norms.
So what kind of oral traditions did they have?
A really rich body of folklore, preserved orally for centuries before being written down much later. Epic poems narrating history or legend. Tragic love stories like Mem Uzin, written down in the 17th century but with much older roots, or Kej Usiabend, were incredibly popular.
Any other types?
Historical epics recounting resistance, like the story of Dimdim Castle. Moral tales, like Zembel Farosh. Folk tales with recurring characters, like the trickster figure Keselak. And, of course, countless proverbs and riddles encapsulating collective wisdom.
And the people who told these stories, the Dengbej, they were important figures.
Absolutely vital. The Dengbej were the bards, the epic singers, the oral historians. They often accompanied themselves on an instrument like the tembur, a lute. Then you also had the Strenbej, singers who performed more lyrical songs, often at social gatherings. These performers weren't just entertainers. They were keepers of memory, teachers, moral guides.
And music and dance were also central to life.
Integral. Music was passed down orally, covering everything from history to love poems called lawuk. For celebrations, the difu zurn, the big drum, and the loud oboe-like instrument was almost essential.
What other instruments did they use?
Flutes like the blur or ney, double clarinets like the duzel or zimara. Village songs often use call and response patterns. Music in towns, played by semi-professional musicians, could sometimes be more complex melodically.
And specific songs for specific activities.
Yes, definitely. Work songs like Kelhori for traveling or hunting, milking songs, manga yowana, and of course distinct melodies for weddings, serdare. Music marked the rhythms of life.
Let's talk about daily life and social customs. Was there a clear structure to family life and work?
Very much so. The basic family unit might look nuclear, but it was always embedded in a wider patrilineal extended family linked through the father's line. Leadership usually passed from father to eldest son. When women married, they typically moved to their husband's family home that's called patrilocal residence. A single nomadic tent or household could easily contain several generations.
And the division of labor we touched on earlier was quite defined.
Yes, quite clearly. Women handled milking, dairy processing, cooking, cleaning, childcare, collecting fuel and water, spinning, weaving, sometimes helping with harvest. Men were primarily responsible for plowing, sowing, harvesting, the main herding tasks, or hiring a shepherd, taking goods to market, making purchases. Children helped out with age-appropriate tasks, and elders were respected for their knowledge.
And marriage. How were partners chosen?
Marriage was often rooted in kinship and tribal strategy. Arranged marriages are common, aimed at strengthening ties within the lineage or building alliances with other groups.
Was there a preference for marrying relatives?
Yes. Lineage endogamy, marrying within the lineage, is often preferred, especially marrying your father's brother's daughter, a first cousin. This was seen as keeping the family wealth and solidarity intact. Bride wealth, quam, paid by the groom's family to the brides, was a standard part of the negotiations.
Could people get divorced?
Divorce was possible for men, usually following Islamic custom by renouncing the wife three times. The preference for marrying within the lineage might have reinforced the segmented nature of tribal society, perhaps limiting broader alliances.
It paints a picture of a very structured, traditional society, but they weren't totally isolated, were they? They encountered outsiders.
No, definitely not isolated. Their lives were significantly shaped by encounters, particularly with European travelers who wrote about them, and later by the sedentarization policies of the big empires.
We know Marco Polo mentioned Kurds way back in the 13th century.
Yes, and from the 16th century on, more travelers, missionaries, diplomats passed through. Hans Christoph Freiherr von Teufel used the word Chirto for Kurds in the late 1500s. The 19th century saw a real boom in European interest, collecting folklore, studying customs, mapping territories.
People like Ida Pfeiffer, Ely Bannister Soane, Major Noel, their accounts must be valuable sources.
They offer fascinating glimpses, absolutely. Pfeiffer wrote about women's roles in the 1840s. Soane's book, based on his travels in disguise in the early 1900s, is incredibly detailed on tribal life, migrations, customs. Noel's 1919 diary also has observations.
But we need to read them carefully.
Definitely. They come with the biases and perspectives of their time and background. They're valuable but need critical reading. At the same time these Europeans were observing, the Ottoman and Persian empires were pushing harder to settle the nomads.
Sedentarization, trying to make them settle down. This sounds like a major disruption. Why did the empires want to do this?
Several reasons. To extend state control into areas where it was weak. To make it easier to tax people and draft them into the army. To control groups they saw as potentially rebellious or lawless. And often, there was an idea that settled farming was more civilized and productive than nomadism.
So it was about control and changing their way of life.
Fundamentally, yes. Undermining tribal autonomy, integrating these areas more fully into the state.
How did they try to implement it?
Sometimes by forcing nomads to settle in existing villages, which could cause friction with people already living there, like Armenian communities in some areas. Other times by creating new agricultural settlements.
Did the Kurds just accept this?
Often not. Resistance was common, ranging from negotiation to outright refusal and sometimes armed conflict. The states used tactics from persuasion to coercion to military force. Trying to break down tribal loyalty was often part of the package.
You mentioned friction with settled peasants earlier. Before these forced settlement policies, what was that relationship typically like?
It was complex. There was interdependence trade, as we discussed. Nomads needed grain, peasants needed animal products. But there was also potential for conflict over resources, especially grazing land and water, particularly during the winter, kushlak, when nomads might camp near villages.
Did the state ever get involved in managing that relationship?
Sometimes. Ottoman officials might formally grant wintering rights, kushlakye, to a tribe in a specific area, maybe in return for taxes or loyalty.
But the sedentarization policies made things worse.
They often did, yes. Forcing settlement created direct competition for land between newly settled nomads and established villagers. It upset traditional land use patterns and power balances.
Yes, particularly in the late 19th century, there are documented instances where some Kurdish tribes, sometimes encouraged or enabled by state policies favoring settlement or certain groups, ended up dispossessing settled populations, including Armenian peasants, of their lands. State intervention fundamentally changed the dynamic, often turning coexistence, however uneasy, into direct antagonism. So wrapping this up, looking back at the pre-modern nomadic Kurds, their whole way of life seems like an incredible feat of adaptation and resilience.
It really does. Adapting to a challenging environment, navigating the pressures of powerful neighboring empires, maintaining their own distinct cultures and social structures for centuries.
From those complex tribal systems, the seasonal migrations that define their year, to the richness of their oral traditions and crafts, they built a unique and remarkably enduring identity.
And even though modernization, centralization, and borders have drastically changed things, you can still see the echoes of that nomadic past in Kurdish culture today. It hasn't vanished entirely.
This has just been a glimpse, of course, into a really deep and fascinating history. We hope it encourages you, the listener, to explore further. What parts of this nomadic life resonate most with you? Or what questions does it leave you with? There's always more to uncover.